I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Cullen Murphy writes in his new book that there were three forms of torture used during the Inquisition: the pulley, the rack, and a technique that can only be called waterboarding. Murphy's book is God's Jury, the Inquisition, and the Making of the Modern World. The Inquisition lasted nearly 700 years, beginning in the 13th century. While it has its medieval roots, Cullen says the Inquisition has left its mark on contemporary society through acts of persecution, surveillance, interrogation, torture, and censorship. Cullen also writes that paradoxically, the Inquisition marked the beginning of the modern world. Cullen Murphy is editor at large of Vanity Fair and joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Marty.
So let's go back to the year 1231. Pope Gregory the Ninth appoints inquisitors of heretical depravity. What was he trying to root out?
The church faced a problem from its own point of view of a major upsurge in heresy in southern France, northern Italy. And there are a lot of reasons why there was more heresy at that time. We don't need to go into them right now. But from the church's point of view, it was a big problem. And partly it was a problem because there was just concern about people's souls. You have to grant them that. Partly it was a political problem as well. The heretics often had alliances with powerful dukes and so on. And it just wasn't a good thing for a centralizing church to have this flourishing dissent. So the church had tried many different ways of dealing with it, sending preachers in, and nothing really seemed to work. And these groups, the biggest one, which was known as the Cathars, finally the Pope decided he would create basically a new type of person. They were priests, often Dominicans, and they were inquisitors, and they would go into towns and villages and cities. They would talk to people. They would interrogate them. Sometimes they would use torture. They would bring them before tribunals. They would try to get a sense of what their thinking was, who else in the neighborhood thought that way, and they would mete out punishments. And usually the punishments were not fatal. Sometimes they were.
And the idea of heresy, the idea of people speaking out, against the church, challenging the Pope's authority? Is that the definition of heresy 700 years ago?
It's certainly all of that. The Cathars were a pretty clear-cut case. The Cathars believed that the physical world was evil and that only the spiritual world was pure, and they rejected the church and the Pope's authority. And this was a period of time. Nowadays we take it for granted that the Pope is the spiritual head of the Catholic Church, and that was often more of a dicey proposition. But this was happening at a period of time when the popes were centralizing power to a degree that hadn't occurred before. So it was a particular threat at that time.
And were they able, through the Inquisition, to, in a sense, root out the Cathars and stop their heresy?
You can kind of judge for yourself. Have you ever met a Cathar?
No, I have not met a Cathar.
And yet, a couple of days ago, a man came up to me who had read the book, and he said, I read your book, and I'm a Cathar. but he may be the one they missed.
Talk a bit about, I guess, the bureaucracy of the Inquisition, because in part what you say is that it thrived and survived for those centuries, in part because of the creation of this bureaucracy of Inquisition.
Well, exactly, Marty. One of the points in the book has to do with how a regime of intolerance and persecution becomes institutionalized. You read ancient history, you read the Bible, and it's easy to see that episodes of intense violent hatred are just not new. It's part of the human story. But the newer part is how does this impulse get channeled into something where it has legs? It goes from generation to generation and even for centuries. And you need certain tools for that to happen. And one of them is just something that we take for granted nowadays, which is bureaucracy.
Right. An organization.
How do you run an organization? And I'll give you just one example of the extent to which organizational maturity marks this age. This comes from a terrific historian named James Given, who points out that in the year 1200, the papal chancery, which is the group that does the Pope's correspondence, sends out about 300 letters a year. 100 years after that, the papal chancery sends out 50,000 letters. So something very significant is happening to your administrative capabilities during this period of time.
So you have people that are, you have added to your bureaucracy, so there are people that are carrying out these dictates, for instance.
That's right. It's not just that. It's knowing how to run a large organization.
You also say you need a kind of moral certainty, I guess, as part of this bureaucracy. You have to believe that what you're doing and saying is absolutely moral and correct.
That's right. That's kind of the match. And you have to have that. Otherwise, why would you be doing it? But this notion that you believe something to be true so powerfully, and not only that, you believe that it is so important that everybody believes this very same thing to be true, that you have the right to impose that view for their own good. That's what I mean by this notion of moral certainty.
You also write, not knowing where to stop, that turns out to be the central problem of any inquisition, which is where to draw the line.
And it's bound up in part with the idea of bureaucracy. You know, the bureaucracies that we live with in our own age, it's one of the complaints about bureaucracy that they don't know where to stop. They're kind of on cruise control. And now, I'm not going to make any inquisitorial claim about the TSA, but when you look at the airline security and you ask yourself, do I think that this is going to be gone in 10 years, 15 years, 30 years, or do I think that bit by bit new things are going to be added to what we go through and that somehow this regime is going to continue kind of indefinitely? Probably most people suspect it's going to continue indefinitely. And that's partly because that's the way bureaucracies are.
But do you see TSA as a form of inquisition?
Well, that's why I started
No, I don't.
But you do see when you go back to look at the Inquisition that this indefinite bureaucratic progress is very much a characteristic. People are just, in some cases, the people who are doing this work, they're showing up, they're punching the clock, if they had clocks. They're doing the work that's been assigned them. They're not really thinking about it. They probably don't even have this moral fervor any longer. They're cogs in a machine, and there's one instance of inspectors at a port in Portugal, and they've been charged with looking at cargo coming in because it's feared that they might be bringing in books that are pernicious. And this goes on for more than 100 years, and they never find anything. Hmm. But all the charts survive. Nothing here this week, nothing here this week, for over 100 years.
Let me go back to the Inquisition itself and help us understand how torture became part of the Inquisition. Because I have to say that seems so, quote-unquote, unchristian, to be torturing people.
Yeah, it is pretty darn unchristian. The way it arises, I have found really fascinating. There's a particular historian named Ed Peters who has laid out the process very clearly. It begins with the idea of proof. How do you prove that a person is innocent or guilty? And in the earlier part of the Middle Ages, there was a pretty clear-cut way of doing this. You asked for God to decide the issue, trial by ordeal. And we've all heard of that, and it was real. And even though it was primitive and absurd by our lights, at least the people involved in it were able to say to their own satisfaction, you know, God has decided guilt or innocence. But there's a big revolution in legal thinking in the Middle Ages, and just to make it very, very simple, trial by ordeal disappears, and it's replaced by this idea, revolutionary and kind of modern, that we ourselves, human beings, we can figure out guilt and innocence, and that's great. That's a step forward. But then this issue of the proof comes back. When you have God deciding, well, God is always right. But when human beings are decided, how do you know? And so the medieval people figured, well, a confession. What can be better than a confession? And on one level, that's correct. But what if somebody doesn't confess, and yet you really, really think they're guilty? Well, maybe they can be helped to confess. And now suddenly torture comes in, because perhaps if you provide a bit of duress, this confession may come.
You include here a woman who was accused of not eating pork, and I guess by association, perhaps accused of being Jewish. And in her trial, she tries to figure out, how to defend herself. She's being tortured, but she says, "What am I supposed to say?"
Exactly. And I think that's from the Canary Islands, yeah. Which gives you an idea of just how far this spread. But there are many, many Inquisition transcripts. The interrogations were recorded by secretaries. And, in fact, if you look at transcripts of modern interrogations, and some of them have come out over the past few years, they are uncannily similar to the Inquisition transcripts. But one of the things you frequently find is the person who is being tortured is desperately looking for help to figure out, what do I need to say to stop this? Because they truly don't know what it is that they've done wrong or what the inquisitors are looking for.
And in a sense have no way to defend themselves under these trials or tribunals.
Well, exactly. And they have no reason to defend themselves for another reason, which is, usually they don't know what the charges are against them. And they also don't know who the witnesses are. And, this is, the Middle Ages is no different from our own time, in that there are grudges, there are feuds, especially in small places, and an awful lot of animosity gets wrapped into this that has nothing to do with religion.
And that's Cullen Murphy, our guest today on Radio Times, author of God's Jury, The Inquisition, and the Making of the Modern World. We're taking a very short break, opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, an evening of French gypsy jazz at the Django Ogogo Festival. Inspired by the music of Django Reinhardt, guitarist Stefan Remmel, who composed the theme to Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, will offer an energetic performance with no set break, beginning at 5:45. More details are available at philamuseum.org.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
You may remember us from WHYY's last membership drive.
If you had access to YStream, then you missed out on all our witty banter.
And if you'd like to miss out on it again, you can.
Act now and pledge for YStream. It's WHYY-FM without the pledge break.
That's right, Ed, but this offer won't last.
The last day to sign up for this thank you gift is January 29th. For details, visit whyy.org/YStream.
Tonight, it's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Melissa Block. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech. It's an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Cullen Murphy about the Inquisition, the subject of his new book, God's Jury. He's editor-at-large of Vanity Fair. And we have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You talked a bit about the bureaucracy of the Inquisition. Talk a bit about Bernard Guy. Who was he?
Well, Bernard Guy was an inquisitor in the early 14th century. He died around 1330 or so. And if you want to see a picture of him, you can go see the movie The Name of the Rose, and you'll find that he looks a lot like F. Murray Abraham. But he was a major inquisitor, a very big deal. And he wrote something called, the Latin name is Practica, but it was a guide for inquisitors. It was a how-to book, and it's an extraordinary piece of work. It has things like sample dialogue. If you're an inquisitor, you know, what do you ask? And then it puts in what the person you're interrogating says, and then it recommends how you respond to that. And this is just the first example of an entire genre of interrogation handbooks, which have a very modern feel to them.
Including the kind of back and forth, and even it almost sounds like the psychology of interrogation.
Exactly. You know, the police departments, intelligence agencies nowadays, they have a whole raft of techniques where they try to get into the heads of people they're talking to. And this, I should emphasize, this isn't about torture.
Right.
And the medieval inquisitors used all those same techniques, you know, good cop, bad cop. Well, you had good inquisitor, bad inquisitor. You had
breaking somebody down, I guess, or wearing them down.
Exactly. You had instances where, you know, someone would the person to be questioned would come into the room, and the inquisitor would be there with a huge stack of documents, as if anything that the person being questioned could say, well, we have the real proof right here. It was very, very intimidating, and Guy left an extraordinary other document, which is in the British Library, which is a summation of all his cases that he kept. Every person he questioned, every person he tried, every sentence that he decreed, and it's all there in one volume. It's an amazing example of meticulous record keeping, which is another aspect of the Inquisition that that is worth noting.
Well, you include, and this is an itemized accounting of expenses for the burning of four heretics in 1323 from Carcassonne, four large wood, for vine branches, for straw, for four stakes, for ropes to tie the convicts, and then money for the executioners, each 20 souls in all, 8 livres, 14 souls, 4 deniers.
Exactly. And this kind of accounting, you know, the expense account it's a very common sort of document.
You know, reading that, I was thinking of the Nazis, who also meticulously documented so much of what they did during the Holocaust. You're saying that the documentation is part of the inquisitorial, spirit approach?
I think it is. You know, of course, there are many, many legitimate reasons to collect information. So I don't want to discount that. But the fact is that a regime of any kind that wants to conduct a campaign of repression has to be a record-keeping regime. You have to know who people are, where to find them, what they think, how they move, and that requires paperwork. And not only do you have to write all this stuff down, you need to know how to find it again, which is, I mean, anybody who has an attic or a kitchen drawer knows the difference between saving something and finding it again. But these tools were very well developed, and Inquisition records survive in vast numbers. We don't have anything like all of them, but they are very considerable.
You describe in some detail the pulley, the rack, and then when you describe the kind of water torture, That is waterboarding, as from your description and what I understand about waterboarding, that was done during the Inquisition.
It is waterboarding, and the description of the technique back in the Middle Ages and later is, you know, it's clear that it's the same thing that has been used during the past decade in various places, including by the United States. Mm-hmm. And now, the question that always comes up with waterboarding is, well, is it really torture?
Right.
And this, you know, on the one hand, you can get into a semantic debate over what torture is. And, you know, if you want to get into that, we can. But possibly a simple answer is, well, the Bush administration perhaps might not have called it torture, but we can say for sure that the Inquisition called it torture. So, and they were kind of experts on torture. So if you're going to say it's not torture, you're disagreeing with people who used torture as just part of their ordinary way of doing business.
And that's Cullen Murphy, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about the Inquisition, the subject of his new book, God's Jury, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. It's about the history of the 700 years of the Inquisition and also some of the parallels to today's world. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get a couple of callers in, and then I do want to talk about Spain. We have Charles from Gilbertsville joining us. And Charles, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if he thought the Holocaust might be a continuation of the Inquisition, particularly the fact that the Inquisition went after the Jews. When you figure so many of the countries, if not most of the countries that fought with the Germans, whether it be Austria, Italy, Hungary, Slovenia, Slovakia, are overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. And even when the Jews who survived went back to Poland, which is also overwhelmingly Catholic, in many cases, they were murdered, and certainly were not allowed to stay in their homes and get their possessions back. Does he think that might have played a is a continuation of the Inquisition?
Charles, thanks for the call.
Sure.
Yes, that's a great question, and you know, I could answer that narrowly by, you know, talking about the Inquisition as an institution, and, you know, and noting that, you know, there was no, you know, explicit connection between the Inquisition and the Holocaust, but I don't really think that's what you're asking. I think you're asking for something broader, and when you broaden the question out, there is a connection. So when it comes to persecution of Jews, there's a long history in the church of negative and antagonistic and harmful and hurtful commentary about Jews from a very early time. And James Carroll, in his terrific book Constantine's Sword, has traced this in great detail. And it is something that the church has always had difficulty coming to terms with. And I don't know how you can argue that that sensibility that was supported by the church didn't play a role in attitudes that suffused Europe. So that's the way I would answer your question. I think it's a good point.
Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Also targeted during the Inquisition, besides Jews, Muslims were targeted, Protestants, free thinkers, all meted out with the same kind of judgment.
Yeah, I was going to say the only safe thing to be was a Catholic, but in fact,
then,
that wasn't. The targets shifted over time, over circumstance, and over place. And, you know, that early Inquisition we were talking about, which went after the Cathars and was very successful, move on a couple of centuries, and the Spanish Inquisition is targeting Jews and Judaizers, people who had once been Jewish and had been converted, usually forcibly, and who the authorities suspected were secretly continuing to practice as Jews. Muslims were in the same position. You know, Spain, remember, was a place that had been ruled by Muslims for a long period of time. There was a great deal of mingling among Muslims and Christians and Jews. And then the Protestant Reformation occurs in the early 16th century, and that is a huge challenge that the church, from its point of view, must face. And it's combined with another challenge, which is the printing press, which is a big, big problem.
Disseminating all this information, yes?
Disseminating all kinds of information, and much of it the church doesn't like at all. And it's very hard to control. It was easier for the church to control, publishing, to use that word, which really means copying things by hand, if most of the copying was being done by essentially priests. But now you've got printing presses. It's like the internet arriving suddenly. And, what are you going
to
do?
Yeah. Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have John from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. And, John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Fascinating program today.
Thank you.
I have a strong interest in Spanish history and Spanish culture. I've been to Spain a number of times. And one of the things that's always struck me is that you can have a really quick knee-jerk reaction against the Inquisition, and I'm certainly not an apologist for the horrors of the Inquisition. But it seems to me that since hindsight is always 20/20, if you get into the mindset of the people back then that had just finished this quote-unquote crusade against the Moors in Spain, and given their proximity to Africa, just across the Straits of Gibraltar, that sense of insecurity must have really been a very scary thing, given, too, that Ferdinand and Isabella had just united a country that had different realms, that had different cultures, God, they spoke languages, that all of this, that the only uniting factor that they had was their religion, really. And that from that standpoint, creating an Inquisition to kind of secure the country under that religion seemed to make perfect logical sense for them.
Well, John, let me take your point because it's an interesting one. I want to give Cullen Murphy a chance to weigh
in.
Sure,
please.
No, thanks for calling in.
It's a terrific question. I'll start with your comment about hindsight always being 20/20, and I kind of wish it was, but it often isn't. That's why historians argue so much, and they wouldn't if it was 20/20. But the point that you raise is a good one, and I understand what you're saying about you're not trying to apologize; you're just trying to understand and explain. And you've put your finger on something that is real. The situation in Spain at that time, a recently unified kingdom, and from the point of view of the monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, who we know from a different context.
Yes.
And from their point of view, a unifying forces were desperately needed. And the Inquisition was seen by them as a unifying force in a country that didn't have many. And the unlike other Inquisitions, the Inquisition in Spain was under the control of the Spanish crown for that reason. It was not run by the Pope. It was run by the king or the king and the queen. So you're definitely elaborating on something that has real truth to it. But let me move beyond that to one other point. So to say that there was an urgent need for something to occur, and therefore that you're not doing this, but the Spanish crown was, they are moving to the next step and saying, well, because there is that urgent need, anything that we do to promote it is justified because the cause is so important from our point of view. And this gets back to that notion of moral certainty that I was talking about earlier, and it's the thing to beware of always.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And just picking up on that, Isabel and Ferdinand appointed Torquemada to, in a sense, carry out the Inquisition in Spain.
Yes. Now, everybody, in my experience, there are a few things that everybody knows about the Inquisition.
Exactly.
And one of them is Monty Python, and one of them is Torquemada. And Torquemada was a Dominican priest, and he was an inquisitor. He had been Isabella's confessor when she was younger, and then through her influence, he also became Ferdinand's confessor. And he was the first inquisitor general of the Inquisition and basically presided over it during the from around 1480 to the mid-1490s. And it was a particularly brutal time under his regime. He was zealous. He wore a hair shirt. Mm. He always traveled with armed guards, with reason. Died in his bed. Died in his bed, a rich man. And so his name has always been associated with the Spanish Inquisition, because you know, he not only gave it its start, but he was the administrator during one of the most intense periods.
So his his legacy is,
well,
the brutality of
certainly that. Probably 2,000 people were burned at the stake on his watch, a period of about 15 years.
There was also the people would be paraded through the streets. I mean, the use of humiliation as a form, as one of the tactics of interrogation.
That's right. And it was a procedure called the auto-da-fe. And this is another word that we all see. We apply it sometimes to things like book burnings. And you know, there is a real association there. So what would happen is, the people who had been tried before the Inquisition, they would, when the time for sentencing came, there would be a grand ceremonial occasion, and the people to be punished would be lined up. They'd be paraded through town. There would be, you know, sometimes there would be, you know, diplomats, visiting royalty would be there to watch, and of course a large throng would be there to watch, and some people had been convicted who had already died, but their reputations were, you know, being condemned. They would be dug up from their graves, put in carts, and their bodies would be part of this procession as well. The people to be burned at the stake would then be carted off in that direction, and there'd be the pyres would be lit, the living as well as any of the exhumed people. Others would be wearing penitential garb, the San Benito gown, which was a white gown with a yellow cross on it. You know, one historian, Henry Kamen, points out that because depictions of auto-da-fe survive in some, you know, extraordinary paintings at the Prado and elsewhere, you get the impression that this kind of, it's almost a Disneyfied auto-da-fe was routine. And it was, there was a small version of it that was routine. These large ones were much more infrequent.
I do want to pick up on that after this very short break, talking with Cullen Murphy today on the show about his book, God's Jury, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. And we'll take some more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
In Philadelphia, everyone is reading Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work by Edwige Dantica. Celebrating its 10th anniversary in 2012 with lead sponsor Walmart, the Free Library of Philadelphia's One Book, One Philadelphia program kicks off on January 25th with a free special performance by Kuumba Drum and Dance Troupe at 7:30 p.m. at the Parkway Central Library. Details at freelibrary.org/onebook. The Free Library of Philadelphia proudly supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Glock, the lightweight, high-capacity magazine Austrian pistol, became the gun of choice for American criminals and law enforcement agents, and found its way into crime movies, TV shows, and rap lyrics. We talk with Paul Barrett, author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. President Obama will deliver his State of the Union. We'll ask voters across the country, what do you want to hear? Also, the Oscar nominations are announced. Which films made the coveted shortlist, and will you have seen them? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Cullen Murphy, Vanity Fair editor at large and author of a new book called God's Jury. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. As you said, these parades were probably not as common as we thought they were. But I was thinking about the psychology of it. One would be to whip up the crowd. I mean, and to sort of give them a taste of that kind of mob psychology, but also as a kind of cautionary tale as well, which is that, you know, if you don't kind of keep in line, this could be your fate.
Well, exactly. The cautionary element here is in some ways a part that gets lost. You know, there has been there's been discussion and debate over what the total number of people killed by the Inquisition is. And, you know, we don't really know. It's certainly tens of thousands, but that doesn't really get at the full picture, because for every one of the people who was burned at the stake, you know, that was maybe 2% of all the people who came before an Inquisition tribunal. That means 98%, which is hundreds of thousands of people, have been subjected to something in an Inquisition tribunal. And that's a lot of people. You know, you're dealing with a Europe that is much, much smaller than it is today. And hundreds of thousands of people, plus factor in their families. So the psychological penetration of the Inquisition would have been very large.
Let me get, looks like Faith from Logan Circle to join us on Radio Times. Faith, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Mr. Murphy. I've been told by certain people in the women's movement that 7 million women died over the years of the Inquisition, which they extend into the Salem witch trials in this version, and that women herbalists or practitioners of paganism were particularly targeted. What's your opinion on that?
Thanks for the call, Faith. Yeah, go ahead.
7 million is not a credible number, but you know we don't know what specific numbers are for particular groups. There are many types of people who were targeted by the Inquisition. Homosexuals, for instance, were also targeted, and the kind of people who were, from the church's point of view, dabbling in realms that were not legitimate, and herbalists would be an example of that. People who were involved in other kinds of superstitious activities would be involved in that. They did become targets. It was never the main target, and the numbers would have been smaller than the other kinds of groups. But it certainly is true that people from these outlier groups would have been involved.
Mm. Faith, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get to modern day, because in part your book draws some parallels. And you talk about the inquisitional impulse, bureaucracy, surveillance, censorship, moral certainty. Where do you see that today?
Well, let me just start with surveillance. We haven't really touched on that. We know what the situation with surveillance is now. Partly, it's being conducted without ourselves really being aware of it. It's happening automatically. Now, surveillance didn't used to be a routine activity, but during the Middle Ages, you begin to see that it is becoming more organized, more systematic. In the Spanish Inquisition, you had a group of people known as familiars, who were not priests; they were local individuals, and they often had jobs connected with the government. But part of their job was just to keep tabs on what people were doing, what people were thinking, and the number of these people was considerable. You know, there's in Valencia at one point there was one of these familiars for every 42 households.
Wow.
which is quite, you know,
talk about bureaucracy, right?
Quite a lot. Even in the medieval Inquisition, there were instances of people being rounded up, questioned about their neighbors, and of course, neighbors know what neighbors know, and just keeping immense records of of what people did and thought, down to picayune things like who was sleeping with who, or what sexual aids they were using. To look at some of these documents, they often have a very modern feel to them.
What about, I'm thinking of Vice President Dick Cheney would talk about that 1% doctrine, the idea that we have to do whatever we can to stop a terrorist. Do you see that? Not that it's necessarily it's part of this Inquisition, but do you see it as part of that inquisitional impulse? Or inquisitor? I'm not even sure what the adjective is there, but go ahead.
Dick Cheney's famous quote has to do with if there's even a 1% chance of some catastrophic event occurring, you have to act as if there's a 100% chance, and you have to act with utter certainty, and everything else in effect must bow before it. And to my mind, this is the epitome of inquisitorial thinking, because it makes a particular justification an absolute, and no other considerations of principle or moderation are allowed in, because you have defined this one cause as paramount. And that kind of thinking is extremely dangerous. It's the kind of thinking, and I'm not going to equate Dick Cheney with Nazis, but it is the kind of thinking that has led to horrific decisions by governments in the past, and you can find many examples. And the reason it does so is because it puts aside and locks in a vault certain safety valves in our thinking. And those safety valves are things like humility or tolerance or doubt or second thoughts. And when you put those things aside, you are creating trouble for yourself.
Let me ask you about the National Defense Authorization Act, which was passed, signed with signing statements by President Obama. But it includes in there the authority that the military would have to detain and interrogate U.S. citizens and non-citizens, deny them legal protections by the U.S. Constitution.
Exactly. This was signed into law just a couple of weeks ago by President Obama over his own objections.
Right.
And
he said he would not carry them out if he, as president.
That's right. And it may be that he will not, but the power now exists. This is an example of just the persistence of once something is created, it never ratchets back. It sometimes ratchets forward by increments, especially in the security area. And partly this is a bureaucratic thing, and partly it has to do with this impulse that we've been talking about, where when you've established that some goal is more important than absolutely every other goal, then you can always justify every single step that you're going to propose to reach that goal.
Let me get, looks like Mitch from New York to join our conversation. Mitch, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. It's a pretty fascinating conversation you got going.
Thanks.
Here.
Thanks.
I remember years ago when I was doing some undergraduate work, I cited an article from the Chicago Law Review. I think the guy's name was Richard Feynman. In the article, he equated the law of torture. It most closely resembles to criminal law in the United States in the way it's practiced, the way the criminal justice system works. And what he said was that instead of crushing bones, or pulling joints out of the socket, we use the plea bargain system, and the coercive factor is the threat of increased, dramatically increased time in jail. And I was thinking about this, jumping over into modern times, and how many people, the percentage of people in jail now, probably close to 98% of the people in prison took a plea agreement to get there, and we have that the highest incarceration rate in the world, and the moral certitude that we have in our criminal justice system and war on drugs and war on crime and things of that nature.
Well, Mitch, thanks for the call. Yeah, what do you think, Colin Murphy?
Well, I don't know enough about the law to be able to respond intelligently, but I know the Chicago Law Journal is an eminent publication. I find myself looking at certain legal parallels in a different way from Mitch, and that has to do with from time to time we've appointed special prosecutors to do special investigations, and some of these actually seem to me very inquisitorial, partly because they're open-ended. They go on and on and on. There's no restriction of resources. They broaden out to include more and more people, and it's just hard to know where they mm-hmm. end. And the prosecutors themselves don't know how to end them. There's the one that was conducted by Ken Starr.
I was thinking of Ken Starr as you were talking.
But there are others. It's not a Democratic or Republican thing. Mm-hmm. It's inherent in the nature of the special prosecutor. And there's a famous case in the Middle Ages of one bishop who rounds up the entire town of Montaigu and interrogates them for 2 years and produces this amazing document. But you can tell that he was having trouble stopping because it was just so interesting, if only for that reason.
Let me see what – thanks, Mitch, for calling. Cynthia from Ardmore has to Cynthia from Ardmore has to say. Cynthia, go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Hi there. My question for Mr. Murphy is, I saw a little bit of the article in Commonweal. Could he describe the cooperation the Vatican gave him in this research or the atmosphere or spirit of the Inquisition today? I don't know.
Oh, no, it's a good question.
Yes.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Thank you. We haven't touched on this, and so let me just give you just a little bit of background. There are archives of the Inquisition all over the place, in Italian towns and in Spain and France, and there are lots of them also in the Vatican from the third of these inquisitional periods. And they've been there for 450 years, and they are vast. And for a long period of time, the Vatican didn't allow anybody to look at them. And they're all in a palazzo right next to St. Peter's inside the Vatican's gates. And in 1998, Cardinal Ratzinger, the man who is now the Pope, after much importuning by scholars, decided that he would indeed open these archives to historians. And he did. Some of the impetus was provided by a great historian named Carlo Ginzburg, who wrote a wonderful book called The Cheese and the Worms. But since 1998, the Inquisition archives have been studied and picked over by lots of scholars. I think there are about 100 come every single year to work on them. And it's run very professionally. It's not, like you have to go in and bribe someone to bring you a document. This is run like an archive at an American university. And I give the Vatican great credit for having done that. That said, not everything is open. 1939 is always the trouble spot, because that's when Eugenio Pacelli becomes Pope Pius XII, and we know where that leads, and so they're very standoffish on that subject. But up until 1939. The archives are open.
Cynthia, thanks for calling into Radio Times. So the Inquisition, which of course was many Inquisitions, lasted about 700 years. Was there an official end to the Inquisition?
Yes, and those of you who think that it might have been in, you know, 1700, 1800, actually it's 1908 when finally the Roman Inquisition, which is the one that was run, you know, by the papacy itself to counter the Protestant Reformation, it finally is formally abolished. And to some extent, that's just a name change. There's a department at the Vatican today, which is called the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and it is the theological watchdog to this day. And it is the bureaucratic successor to the Congregation of the Inquisition. And in fact, it still is in the same building.
We're almost out of time here. I read that the last execution under the Inquisition, 1826.
Yes, in Spain.
In Spain. Yes. And who was the victim?
He was a school teacher. And, you know, a heretical school teacher, of whom we have many today, no doubt. And he was not burned at the stake. He was garroted.
Garroted. Mm. Well, Colin Murphy, it's been a great pleasure to talk about the Inquisition with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marty.
And the book is called God's Jury, the Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. And he's editor at large of Vanity Fair. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us.